This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
I'm in charge here.
The level of denial.
I never said there was no massacre. Of course there was a massacre.
To call it a massacre, I'm not sure if there is a charge on the statute books.
But you want to hang me because I say this was not genocide. You want to hang me. You want to crucify me because I say this was not genocide.
Massive ethnic cleansing had been carried out by the Serbs, particularly against the Muslims.
The praising of these war criminals.
Alhamdulillah, we are in contract to purchase this 35,000 square foot facility to make it the Dean Center, and in it there will be a masjid, inshallah. The last and final messenger sent to mankind, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, said that the one who helps build a masjid for Allah, Allah will build for them a house in Jannah. Get the tremendous rewards and donate right now to help purchase this property. May God Almighty Allah reward all of you.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, assalamu alaikum, greetings of peace. Welcome to the Deen Show. I'm Eddie, your host, and my next guest, Robert McNeil, had a 40-year career in pathology in Scotland as a mortuary operations manager. In 1996, he volunteered to travel to Bosnia and Herzegovina on behalf of the Physicians for Human Rights and the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia to help gather evidence against suspected perpetrators indicted of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. As a forensic technician, he gathered evidence from the victims' bodies from hundreds of mass graves around Srebrenica and other parts of Bosnia and Herzegovina, but also in Croatia and Kosovo. He carried out similar work in Africa, Thailand, Ireland, and France, and in 1999, he was honored by Prince Charles for his work. He has now written a book called Grave Faces about his work in Bosnia and Kosovo, and he's here with us. How are you doing, Robert?
Hello, Eddie. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much for accepting the invitation. So are you currently residing in the UK?
Yes, I live in Glasgow in Scotland, and that's where I'm speaking to you from my home.
So tell me, give us a very simple understanding of the kind of work you're an expert in, starting from pathology to the forensic technician. For the average person, they haven't heard these type of expertise that you were involved in. Can you break it down for us, for the layman?
Yes, well, I was, as you said, Eddie, I was the mortuary operations manager for covering all the mortuaries in Glasgow. And for many years, I worked alongside the pathologists. We worked together very closely, establishing the causes of death at autopsies. Mainly from people who had died of natural causes, but also in murder, suicide, and medical negligence cases. And so I had a lot of experience before being asked to go to the former Yugoslavia to start as part of the first international team of forensic specialists, including pathologists, anthropologists, police officers, and a radiographer from all over the world, really, and that's how I ended up in Bosnia after being invited by PHR, the charity based in Boston, who had appealed for forensic specialists throughout the world to volunteer to go to Rwanda, actually, initially. And I had volunteered to go there at first until I was contacted by phone to change my plans and instead to go out to Bosnia.
Had you had much experience with Bosnia before? Have you ever visited Bosnia before? Did you know much about it at all?
No, that's a good question, Eddie. I'm ashamed to say it now, but I had honestly never heard of Bosnia. I knew all about the former Yugoslavia and the breakup of the six countries there in early 1990s. But gradually, when I became aware of the conflicts that were going on in the former Yugoslavia, Bosnia was increasingly being reported on in the media. And all I knew about the former Yugoslavia was how beautiful a country it was, and that tourism was one of their main industries. And so, and certainly from people in Europe would often travel there on vacation. And so that was about as much as I knew. I'd been reading up on, I'd been reading up on the history of the genocide in Rwanda, and I was quite clear on what I was going to be doing there. But I have to say that the war in Bosnia seemed to be so complicated that I left it until I went out there to try and learn for myself exactly what had happened over the previous couple of years, where, of course, Slobodan Milosevic, the president of Serbia, had decided to carve up the former countries in the Balkans and create a greater Serbia. Countries in the former Yugoslavia decided differently, that they wanted to be independent countries and run them themselves. Mm-hmm.
So tell me now, when you got there, you get on the ground, what's the feeling like? What are you seeing? Describe to us, as soon as you get there, what's going through your mind, your body, your soul?
Yeah, well, we arrived, eventually arrived in Zagreb in Croatia, and were taken by vehicle down through Croatia and crossed into Bosnia. And almost immediately, there were clear signs of the war. In fact, we had to stop at one point at a gas station to fill up the vehicle, and a UN driver pointed to a pole that had been stuck in the ground, where he explained that Muslims had been impaled in those poles in order to prevent them from entering those particular areas, because I had learned that massive ethnic cleansing had been carried out by the Serbs, particularly against the Muslims. There was many signs of destroyed buildings, not only destroyed, but had been surrounded with mines. And apparently we were told that the Serbs would throw grenades into the house and in order to blow the roofs off them and just completely destroy them to make them uninhabitable. But as we drove further into Bosnia and were becoming more and more aware of the destruction, we began to see refugees. I should explain that this was in 1996, shortly after the Dayton Accord, and people were trying to find their way home, or indeed to find somewhere else to live. And so the roads were full of poor people who had obviously suffered. And what struck me, Eddie, was when I saw people living in buildings with no roofs on them, and the frontage of the buildings had been destroyed. Mm. And it was a surreal sight, because people were cooking on fires and children were playing with toys and so on. And it reminded me actually of a child playing with a doll's house, except that it was so awful. And the other thing that we noticed quite often in our drive down there was that religious buildings, in particular mosques, had been totally destroyed by the Serbs. And I learned later that this was a way of trying to destroy not only the Muslim population, but their culture and religious places as well. And so when we arrived in the city of Tuzla, where we were going to be based, We were billeted with various local people who had volunteered to let us live in their homes while we went out to the mass graves. And I soon realized that you could hardly find a single person in the city who hadn't been affected by the war. The couple we lived with, well, two women, a mother and daughter, were waiting in vain, I should say, for the woman's husband and the daughter's father to return home. He had been in Srebrenica, and the family were told that he would be questioned and then sent out of Srebrenica to the next safe area, which was Tuzla. And I find it very sad that each night she would set a dinner plate, for her husband in the hope that he would return home. And certainly while we were there, he never did. And so that was my first reaction, was one of great sadness about the suffering that people had experienced. Tuzla as well, of course, wasn't exempt from the horrors because there was much destruction of the structure there.
So you pretty much traveled through the whole country?
More or less, from Zagreb directly down to Tuzla. It was quite a long drive. And as I say, I'm glad I did that. There was no flights available at that time because the UN in their so-called wisdom had created a no-fly zone. And so this, of course, had a major effect of those people who had been ethnically cleansed to escape the country, because all passenger flights had been cancelled. And so they were left to their own devices for a long time. Mm-hmm. The areas, the huge numbers of people being ethnically cleansed, I mean, eventually there were up to 2 million people trying to find a sanctuary. And another thing that the UN did to try and help, I suppose, but it wasn't really much help, was to create safe areas. Six safe areas had been created in Bosnia, where those who had been ethnically cleansed were told that they should go there and that they would be protected. And I should say, it's quite important to say this, because the word area, when described as a safe area, puzzled me, because why did they call it a safe haven if they were going to protect those people? And the answer is that they didn't want to commit themselves to fighting against the Serbs. And so they made up this word through many meetings about how they could describe it, these places, and they called it safe areas, which really meant nothing at all. And the mandate behind that the UN had was not to fight for the Muslim population or fight against the Serbs. It was really to observe, first of all, and to provide humanitarian aid for those areas, because the population of Srebrenica, one of the first safe areas, had been around something like 7,000, mainly Muslim people, and that had grown to over 30,000 people, almost all having nowhere to live. Mm. And the humanitarian aid was a pitiful failure as well, because we learned that the convoys of food and medical aid that was being sent to those areas, there was a price to pay to the Serbs to allow them through. And that meant that the Serbs would search each convoy, each truck, on the story they gave was to search for weapons, and they didn't want weapons to be provided. And the price they charged the UN for that was to take up to a third of the contents of the trucks. And these aids were stopped numerous times with the same price to pay. And so by the time they reached Srebrenica and the other safe areas, there was very little left for the population, who were held under siege for up to 3 years, and that mm-hmm. included at least two winters.
So your job, if I'm correct, if I understood, is to come on the scene now and to help families identify their bodies, help put pieces together to understand how a person actually died, what happened to this individual, amongst other things. Is this correct?
Well, almost. Our job was simply the brief that we were given by the International Criminal Tribunal was to gather evidence after carrying out meticulous autopsies on each victim to provide evidence, physical and scientific evidence, for the prosecutors to produce in court.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, identification was something that we weren't asked to do. However, of course, anything that we could do to help with the identification process, we would. This was in 1996, and DNA matching at that time wasn't really available. Clothing that was on victims couldn't be used as primary identification because, as I said, that there were people who'd been under siege for so long that the clothing could have belonged to anyone. Someone may have died and passed on those clothes. But nevertheless, the clothing was a helpful indication. It's important to note that all of the women who were expelled from Srebrenica, they had to find their way to Tuzla, the next safe area. And Ratko Mladic, the military commander, had assured them that the men would be taken for questioning and it would be with them soon. So the women, and certainly when I was there, many of them, they didn't make us unwelcome, but they didn't want to hear that their loved ones were dead. They still believed that they were alive and would be returning home at any time. But gradually, they would arrive at the temporary mortuary gates looking for any information about them. And it was heartbreaking to tell them that at this stage we couldn't identify the bodies properly, and that might take some time. And of course, it took many years for the identification. But we did, of course, gather as much evidence on that first deployment as possible. But there were many interruptions, mainly from the media, because it was a major international story at the time. But also, there were those whose interests it might be to disrupt our work, and at one point we had to abandon the temporary mortuary because we were under threat. So we carried on with the work.
Who are you under threats from?
Well, from the Serbs, because although the war had effectively stopped, there was sporadic fighting still going on, and the military informed us that they had intelligence to say that they were going to try and prevent us from doing our work, and we assumed that that meant violence, and so we had to abandon the mortuary for a few days until we got proper full security, when after that we could carry on. Mm-hmm. But that was a feature, certainly in the early days of our deployment to Tuzla. In 1997, when I returned home to Scotland, I was quite depressed because we hadn't really achieved very much. The post-mortem, the autopsies had to be carried out meticulously. We couldn't make any mistakes, mm-hmm. because we knew that there would be high-profile people who had been indicted for these crimes, and they would have some pretty good defence lawyers, etc. But at the same time, bodies were coming in all the time from the graves, which were being discovered, quite often. And I decided in 96, after that first trip, that I would return there the following year. And when I returned there, I committed more time out there this time to try and carry on with the victims from Srebrenica. However, once again, there were interruptions there were bodies being discovered in mass graves in the Prijedor area, where the Serbs had created a number of concentration camps, including the notorious Omarska, Ternopoli, and Keriterm camps. And we learned that up to 150 men and women were being tortured and murdered and thrown into mass graves in those places. And so we've been pulled in different directions to deal with those bodies. And on top of that, there was a NATO Chinook helicopter crash in the vicinity, and that the passengers there were high profile military NATO people and from different countries, and we were asked to deal to identify those bodies as well. But the worst delay came from a different source, which turned out to be particularly awful for the victims' families. We were told that during the winter, graves that we hadn't secured had been re-entered by the Serbs. The bodies, these were the primary graves. The bodies were then removed, torn apart using mechanical diggers. And those body parts were then distributed in much harder places to find further into Republika Srpska. And so, as I said, the families must have been completely devastated by this, because by now, by 1997, they had begun to believe that their men were dead, and all they wanted was to have their bodies returned to them for a decent burial. Instead of the 8,500 men and boys from Srebrenica, we were now faced with up to 17,000 body parts. Many of those body parts had been buried in multiple secondary graves, in the belief, as I say, that we would never find them, and if we did, we would never be able to put them together again, or indeed identify them. And on that score, they were wrong, because the ICTY decided to up the ante as far as personnel were concerned. And I was relieved to learn that forensic specialists from up to 32 countries worldwide were able to provide many more forensic specialists to carry on with the work, because this job, we all knew, was going to take years. And I returned there every year up until 2001, when, by which time, the ICTY had more than enough evidence to prosecute those who were charged.
Tell me, Robert, how long did it take for the international community to confirm that this was indeed a genocide? And a genocide, as we know, by some definition, is a deliberate killing of a large number of people or a particular nation group with the aim of destroying this nation or group. How long did it take for you to be convinced, as an expert, for the international community to confirm that indeed this was a genocide? And is the statement true that this was the greatest genocide that was committed since the war, since World War II?
Well, as a forensic technician, indeed all of the specialists, we are trained to be completely objective in our work. In fact, I had worked with Serb victims and Croatian victims who had been killed as part of the wars there. But what struck me working with the in particular the Muslims from Srebrenica and those from Prijedor was the brutality that was meted out against them. In Srebrenica, for example, many of the men and boys had been badly beaten, their hands tied behind their backs and blindfolded. So it was clear that this was at the very least war crimes, because these men and boys were mainly civilians. When I tried to be objective, I found that sometimes, most of us found this sometimes challenging because of the nature of the deaths. And It's up to the courts, of course, to decide, you know, what the judgment would be regarding the category of crime. I personally believed, although I'm not qualified to say it, that Milosevic and Karadzic and Mladic had focused on the Muslim population in particular. They used that as a weapon of war, if you like, because this war in the West was being described as a civil war of mm-hmm. People fighting one another. They've been doing it for centuries and so on. I personally came to the conclusion after working there on hundreds, if not thousands, of bodies, that this was a war of aggression against a people who believed in Islam and followed that faith. And so one of the things that surprised me, I guess, Eddie, was when the judgments finally came against the main perpetrators. Unfortunately, Milosevic, as you probably know, died whilst he was on trial. But Karadzic and Mladic and Krstic and others, they were the architects of this. It was clear that the Muslim population were being targeted. They were being forced out of Europe, basically. I think that was the plan. What disturbed me a wee bit, I guess, was that the charges of genocide against the main perpetrators was limited to Srebrenica, which was absolutely correct, and to some extent in Sarajevo because of what was happening there. I know, and I have friends, for example, in the Prijedor area, who were very, very upset when the same charge wasn't handed out about the deaths in the camps and indeed in other parts of Bosnia. I remember at the time the judges ruling that they would explain their judgment later on, and I've never heard what that explanation was. But and so at the time when the guilty charges were passed on Karadzic and Mladic in particular, there was sadness plus cheering, particularly around the Potocari area, where the beautiful cemetery now is, that contains over 6,000 of the men and boys from Srebrenica and from other parts of Bosnia. But in Potocari, there was sadness, great sadness, and they felt a bit let down. I mean, the guilty charges were bad enough. There was war crimes, crimes against humanity, and many other charges also, including multiple rape. And, you know, that too was disturbing in that up to 50,000, mainly Muslim women, were systematically raped in Bosnia in an attempt to humiliate them. And sadly, many of those women died or committed suicide. They were forced to take their pregnancies to full term. And that, you know, caused mayhem, you know, in families and so on. So it was a dreadful time. But it did at least establish that rape was indeed a war crime and could form part of a genocide in future. And but that doesn't help those who suffered during that time.
I want to get your thoughts and expert reaction from someone who spent time on the ground there and was a key figure here in Bosnia. So I want to share something with you and get your thoughts on this.
Okay.
But you will not accept that they are sorry. No, I don't want to hear anything more. I've heard your question. I'm answering you. Yes. Thank you. I've heard your question. Let me answer you. I'm fed up. What I said was that this was not genocide. I didn't say it was not a massacre. Let me speak, please. I'm in charge here. I never said there was no massacre. Of course there was a massacre. But you want to hang me Because I say this was not genocide. You want to hang me. You want to crucify me because I say this was not genocide. I said there was a massacre. I said all these Muslims were killed. I know who did it, but you don't know. I know who did it. You don't know. On Judgment Day, you will know.
So is it enough now? This is a person by the name of Imran Hussein. Respectfully, you know, we just wanted to show this. He's a specialist in the area of eschatology, and he's a well-known figure. He's also traveled down there with, we assume, good intentions to try to bring, and this is something we commend, you know, good relations between Orthodox Christians, Muslims, very commendable. But in this area, is this sufficient to say it was a massacre and to deny that it was a genocide?
That this was not genocide. I didn't say it was not a massacre.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as I say, I'm not a lawyer, and I'm certainly not a judge, but I think that the evidence that was provided to the ICTY, to the prosecution, clearly alongside witness evidence, showed that yes, there were thousands of people killed. Now it's one explanation to call it a massacre, but the judges, and they were international judges, I should say, came to the conclusion that to prove genocide is the most difficult charge to prove, really, because they have to show evidence that this was planned, it was against a particular group of people, and that those plans, to a great extent, had been carried out. So as far as the evidence that we provided, as I said earlier, Eddie, there were experts from, including from America, I must say, some of the most eminent experts in the world had traveled there to provide the evidence that I can't believe that people will say that the evidence that was provided was inaccurate or wrong. But it's hard for us to say, you know, whether it constituted a genocide or not. But I firmly believe that and many of us believe that this was a systematic destruction of a particular population, that were easy targets, really, and people that couldn't defend themselves. The UN didn't help by creating an arms embargo where the Serbs and the Croats had huge armies and had plenty of weapons. The Bosniaks didn't have an army at all, and the weaponry that they had to defend themselves was often World War II rifles and so on. And so this was mainly a civilian population that were systematically destroyed, and I understand why people would challenge the court rulings, but they are there, and as I said earlier, it would take an awful lot of evidence for the judges to agree on a charge of genocide. And one of the things that disturbs me and why I wrote this book was that genocide denial is rampant just now in Republika Srpska in particular, and in Serbia, as is the glorification of the war criminals. Now, there's a whole gamut of explanations as to why people deny, and I understand that, but the genocide denial that's going on just now is so dangerous. The people in the Muslims in Republika Srpska and in Bosnia are now terrified that because the leaders of Republika Srpska want to secede from Bosnia, and that could stir up another war. And and so I believe that what we should be doing is challenging the genocide denial. To call it a massacre, I'm not sure if there is a charge on the statute books that people can be prosecuted for a massacre. It was quite clear what the rules were, the terms were wide and varied, but the main ones really were war crimes, crimes against humanity, and mm-hmm. and genocide. But in between those, there were perhaps, I can call them lesser crimes, but mentioned sexual abuse and so on. But there were many crimes that put together could be argued, I guess, that this was a deliberate attempt to rid a part of Europe from the Muslim population.
Mm-hmm. Just to touch upon this also, before we get deeper into your book, and hopefully God willing, we call our elders sheikhs. So Imran Hussein, he can make a change for the better because he has a voice and a lot of people listen to him. So hopefully him listening to this and hearing you, and hopefully he can change, may have a change of heart, maybe come down to visit Bosnia and get on the ground and talk to the people and the scholars there and people like yourself. But he also mentions how there's a deep regret. You know, that's one of the reasons why he also makes this decision.
And they tell me that they are sorry for what happened.
But you mentioned the war criminals being paraded in most cases. I've seen where they have stadiums where people are chanting Ratko Mladic and these other war criminals.
In Belgrade, they are angry that the Bosnian Serb wartime general Ratko Mladic has been arrested. Many came by bus from across the country for the evening rally in the Serbian capital. For them, Mladic is a hero, a defender of the Serb people. The 69-year-old has been indicted for genocide over the siege of Sarajevo and the massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys in Srebrenica.
Support for alleged war criminal Ratko Mladic isn't restricted to Serbia. Fans of the former army chief were out on the streets of Pale in Bosnia-Herzegovina on Thursday night. The town was the administrative centre of the breakaway Republika Srpska during the Bosnian War. People were also showing their support in the former capital, Banja Luka.
Serbs gathered in the eastern town of Bijeljina on Thursday to voice their support for Ratko Mladic and their anger at Serbian President Boris Tadic. Many of the protesters carried Serbian flags and photos of Mladic, who they regard as a war hero rather than criminal.
And these are not like 10, 15 people. This is like, I always compare it to, imagine if you had a whole stadium and people are like chanting for Daesh or ISIS, some of these radical extreme groups, and then the government did nothing about it and they let them go on. So what kind of regret is that? Seems like a hypocrisy. So let's touch upon that. I mean, so you've seen that, you've seen where the praising of these war criminals that happens yearly, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
The commemoration of people such as Ratko Mladic, the butcher, and the others you mentioned.
Yeah.
That's very sad. Yes. It's very sad to see that. I'm bewildered. Like, how do you praise people like this? It's like people praising Hitler or whatnot.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And every time there is an anniversary of a terrible event, for example, in White Armband Day, for example, there's recognition of that in certainly in the UK, and this represents where people from northeastern Bosnia were evicted from their homes. The Serbs had warned every non-Serb to wear a white armband and hang white sheets from their homes. And, you know, you can relate this going back to the Holocaust and what happened to the Jewish people, where they had to identify them as non-Serbs. And there's been great denial from Serbia about that. They said it never happened. And I've actually spoken to members of our Bosniaks who suffered that experience. And I don't know if you can see the painting behind me, but that is about a typical family being evicted from their homes wearing white armbands, and behind them is the concentration camp Omarska, where the woman's husband was incarcerated. So there is great denial about that. In July 11th, every year, the Serbs, and certainly those in Republika Srpska, celebrate that event where up to 8,500 men and boys
were. Help me on. So say that again. Yeah. Repeat that what you just said. So every July 11th, that's when the and who celebrates what?
Well, the Serbs, or some Serbs, not all of them, but particularly those in Republika Srpska, hold rallies, and they celebrate the fact that Mladic had taken Srebrenica for the Serb population, whilst at the same time there is memorials and commemorations going on throughout Bosnia, and certainly in the UK, to commemorate the deaths in Srebrenica and in other parts of Bosnia. And of course, there are Muslims who live in Republika Srpska, who brave people who return to their own homes, who are having to witness that. I know that, for example, a friend of mine whose uncle and brother were murdered by the Serbs on July 11th, when he eventually got his father and brother's body returned to them by the ICTY for burial, along with, I can't remember exactly how, but there was up to 600 people being buried in Potočari on that day. And he describes how, when carrying the coffin along the streets of Srebrenica, there was lines of people on either side, and bearing in mind that Srebrenica is part of Republika Srpska, who were taunting them, spitting on them, and so on, and abusing them, really, whilst this young man was simply trying to bury his loved ones. And this happened to all of the people there. And you have to be very careful when going to Srebrenica itself about what you say and who you say it to, because there is a rawness about those who have been accused of war crimes, and many of them, particularly police officers who are responsible for this, are back on duty again, and it's quite threatening.
Back on duty again. Many of them are back in points. Yeah. This is what Sheikh Imran Hussein, he should go to Republika Srpska. We invite him. He should come down and go ahead, come to the Bosnia and have them take him there. And I went to speak to a commander in the Republican Srpskan Army. He's an older gentleman. He was with the likes of some of these individuals. I went to his church, actually. You can see the video in front of the Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
Honor your father and your mother.
Poštujte oca i majku.
And love your neighbor.
I volite komšiju.
As us, we have to deliver the message of La ilaha illallah. There's nothing worthy of worship except the Creator Allah. We have to do that with compassion, with love. But I say to you here, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. I can go to the hellfire. God will punish me if I say one bad thing of Jesus. In Islam says that we also worship one and only one God.
Kao isto u islamu je monoteizam da se
obožava jedan Bog.
Reading an article where you said, correct me if I'm wrong,
čitao sam jedan članak gdje ste vi rekli, ispravite me ako sam pogriješio,
that you felt like you lost your soul.
Da ste imali osjećaj da ste izgubili dušu.
Did you ever hear or study the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him? So out of his love and mercy, he sent messengers.
Poslao je poslanike i svoje ljubavi.
And they all came with the same message.
Hristos je došao iz ljubavi božanske.
And they all came with the same message for human beings to submit their will to the one God. And I would request that you look more into the life of the last and final messenger sent to mankind, Prophet Muhammad, who came with the same message as Jesus, calling people to La ilaha illallah. There's nothing worthy of worship but the one God, and Muhammad is the messenger. So we would say, if you had the Old Testament, New Testament, the Quran is the last and final testament.
Da li onda možemo reći, ako ima i stari onaj zavjet i novi zavjet, da je Kur'an posljednji zavjet?
Pa, da ti kažem. Kur'an je sveta knjiga.
Da li vi vjerujete da je Muhammed Božji poslanik?
Kako da ti kažem? I vjerujem.
When you have deliberate attempts of denial, praising, commemorating, you know, such criminals. Then how can you move forward? And then you have another side here who are, do we see others from who are, are they a minority who will accept this as something evil that happened, to go ahead and come against? Because as a Muslim, I will condemn any other Muslim who uses, you know, kills innocent people. This is something forbidden in Islam, and we would condemn that, the killing of innocent men, women, and children, clearly. And I don't shy away from that. Do we have others out there who will go ahead and come against these Chetniks and others, these extremists, to go ahead and try to protest these commemorations, like you had mentioned, that happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, the last time I was I've been back to Bosnia mainly on behalf of the charity Remembering Srebrenica UK, and I've taken people, all individuals from various faiths and educators and so on, to Bosnia to for them to learn the story themselves and to meet the people who were affected by it. And we always try to meet with some of the mothers of Srebrenica. That's a group who set up to try and find their loved ones, and they often are at the cemetery to relate their sad stories to the visitors. And I remember asking one of the mothers, or somebody asked, do you forgive the Serbs for what they had done? And her answer was very poignant. I thought she said that, well, we've never been asked for forgiveness. And wow. Perhaps if we were asked to forgive by the people responsible, perhaps they would do it. Whilst they may not forgive, but they'll never forget, no matter whether they forgive or not. And
that's powerful. She said that they never asked for forgiveness. So how could we forgive? Yeah.
Yes,
they exactly. Never asked for forgiveness, so how can we forgive?
Yeah.
Wow.
Which underlines the denial, the level of denial that's being portrayed, where, as I say, new generations have grown up since what happened in Bosnia. There's I think three versions of history been taught in the schools. And of course, the Serbian educators talk about denial as well, and that they try to justify the actions there. So as I say, you're getting young people who are growing up with not unnaturally, totally different stories of the truth, and that's quite disturbing as well.
Yeah. So how can you grow then if you don't admit the mistake? If you don't ask for forgiveness, how are you? And you deny it, then you're probably on your way to possibly do it again, right?
Yeah.
So that's why it's important. You said here, your July 11th is coming up. So my next question is, why is it important to not forget what had happened, and tell us what you go into in your book that Grave Faces. Before you answer that, you were going to say something, please.
Yes, I was going to say, Eddie, that that many of the people who suffered, I think they They appreciate the fact that that people from Europe and abroad, you know, have taken some Americas there, and of course, many specialists work there. The population are at least grateful. Maybe that's not the right word, of outsiders coming to learn what happened there. And I think part of it is that because they felt so abandoned at the time by the politicians in the West and allowed episodes like Srebrenica and many other atrocities to continue throughout the early 90s. And I'm part of, I'm an ambassador for Remembering Srebrenica UK, as I say, and I think that people like myself and other experts who witnessed the level of cruelty and barbarity meted against the mainly Muslim population can help people, as I say, educators and different faiths and so on, albeit a bit late, but nevertheless, I know that the population are very grateful to that people are interested. At last, people are interested. And what I would like to see is for other countries in the world to recognize and to hold a memorial in July or whenever in order to remember them, because my understanding is that the UK is the only country in the world that has regular commemorations of the Srebrenica genocide and the war crimes and so on that happened throughout Bosnia. And in fact, next week, I'll be going to the Houses of Parliament and the Foreign Office, who will commemorate, because it's reached you know, government level, where they nationally we recognise what happened, and also the failures that were by the West and not preventing this terrible war to escalate.
So, yeah. Yeah, we just got a few more minutes left. Yeah, like you said, you had, like you started off in the beginning, it's like I call you over, I say, hey, I got your back, I'm going to take care of you, I'm going to give you a safe haven, a safe zone. And then you have the whole Dutch battalion, they take off and actually let this happen. It's very sad. It's very sad. And I went there, I saw it was like UN and had under there, said United Nothing, because they did nothing. So I toured there. It was very sad. Tell me your book, Grey Faces. Tell us in that book, you talk about many of the things we're discussing. And what else do you highlight in this book? And why is it so important that people who want to know more, that they read and get educated on this? And your book is a great resource, Grey Faces. Tell us more about it.
Well, I kept a diary for many of the deployments that I went on.
Wow. So you actually kept a diary while things are happening. Yep. This is live. You're recording. Yep. Wow.
Each night I would spend an hour writing up what I'd done that day. I mean, it would be very boring to most people. But nevertheless, it was after I retired, actually, I decided that this old battered school jotter could be turned into a manuscript, because I was part of the Remembering Srebrenica organization then, and it occurred to me that that people might be interested in the story for a couple of reasons. One, the forensic side of it, the fact that we went out there in 1996. And it was really just a learning experience, because no one had been involved in anything like this before. But we learned very quickly, and those protocols that we wrote up after that first deployment, we improved on through time. And by the end, 2001, it was a pretty smooth operation, I must say, and a very successful one. It became the biggest forensic investigation in history, and it's arguable that it was the most successful, because many people feel let down because the perpetrators of their crime or their family's crimes hadn't been dealt with. And so also I mentioned genocide denial. I felt that it might be something that could be used to challenge those who deny what happened there. But I also write about my personal experience with the Bosniaks that I encountered there. We lived with, as I said earlier, with local people, both in Tuzla and in Visoko, where we set up a proper mortuary there. And all of them, all of those peoples had suffered, and it was heartbreaking listening to their stories. And I wanted to write about them because I know I'm biased, Eddie, but I fell in love with Bosnia and the Bosniak people. They were so welcoming, even although they had very little, they would share it with us. And I found that very moving. And since then, I've made a number of friends that well, I'm proud to call friends who we still communicate with there. So I wanted to recognise them. And I also write about some of the quite eccentric characters that I worked with. You know, forensic pathologists are lovely people, but occasionally you come across experts who have always had their own way in their own universities or facilities, and it was often a challenge for them to adapt to the quite Spartan conditions that we worked in. And there was a hope, an element of humour as well, because we had to do the job. It was depressing. The place smelled awful all the time, and in the early days, food was sparse. We had to become a family of our own, I guess, you know, because many of us were away from home for quite long times. And so we turned to one another for help and support. And as I say, a wee bit of humour could be injected into that as well. And so I wanted to write various aspects of the book, in particular, about what happened to in the concentration camps and the sexual abuse that was carried out in those camps against both women and men, I must say, because we were asked to look for evidence of sexual assault in men, male victims. And so I just wanted to try and tell as much of the story that I had recorded and turned it into a book that I'm proud to say that Bihar Publishing have now published this book.
I want to commend you. God bless you for all of your amazing efforts that you've put forward, and people can go ahead and benefit from Grave Faces. So where can people pick this book up?
I believe it's available in America now. Mirsad from Bihar Publishing has showed me a photograph of boxes of books. So I believe it may be available on Amazon.
Amazon, huh?
I think so. Could I just add one thing?
Yes, please.
We go, please. And I made up my mind a long time ago that I wouldn't feel comfortable about profiting financially from anything that I do. I'm an artist now as well, and I've painted many paintings about Bosnia and my experiences there. But as far as the book is concerned, I'm donating all of the proceeds for me to it's a wonderful organization run by a woman, a very brave woman called Bakira Hasesic from Visegrad, actually. But her organization, which is called the Association of Women Victims of War, and Bakira and her staff continually support women who have suffered serious sexual abuse, not just Muslims, but mainly Muslims, throughout the war. And Bakira herself has a life commitment to tracking down rapists who were never convicted and exposing them. And so she's an extraordinarily brave woman.
Some of them, like you said, who've got their old jobs back.
Yeah. Exactly.
God bless you. Thank you so much. It was an honor talking to you, Robert. God bless you. And God willing, we can maybe meet sometime in the future in Bosnia.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so, Eddie. Yeah. It's been a pleasure. Thanks very much for highlighting it.
Thank you very much.
Right.
We'll be in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Greetings of peace. As you know, there is so much misinformation being spread about Islam and Muslims by the hate machine, by the Islamophobia industry that manipulates the masses and creates this manufactured fear. And the fear leads to hate, and we know where the hate leads. That's where the Dean Center comes in. Masjid, athletic facility, recording studio, live events, open houses, public relations, educating our brothers and sisters in humanity, being a voice for the voiceless. And the good news is we are halfway to our goal, and we need your help, prayers, and du'as so we can get the other half, close on the property in September, inshallah, God willing. The rest will be paid off, inshallah, over 3 years, owner financing, no interest. Time is ticking, brothers and sisters. Be a part of history. Help make this a reality. Do your part. Donate right now.